This is Free Speech Radio News for April 6th. I'm Matt Martin. Coming up, Slobodan Milosevic under arrest. Will he be tried at home or away? British anti-nuclear protesters go free, but a British high court says they're wrong to call nuclear weapons a violation of international law. Power companies may be forced to pay the price for windfall profits from the California energy crisis, and
the World Bank and the IMF have inspired economic reconstruction projects all over Africa. And wherever they inspire these projects, it has meant more poverty.
Mass protests as the Nigerian government deregulates the price of oil at the behest of the IMF and World Bank. In Belgrade, Yugoslavia, prosecutors from the UN War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague have handed the government of Vojislav Koštunica an official arrest warrant for former President Slobodan Milosevic. The former Yugoslav leader is finishing up his first week behind bars in the Belgrade Central Prison after being arrested last weekend. Meanwhile, his supporters are launching a campaign to free Milosevic and to block his extradition to The Hague Tribunal. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Jeremy Scahill files this report from Belgrade.
Chanting, "We won't give you Serbia," hundreds of supporters of Slobodan Milosevic rallied in front of Belgrade's central prison, where the former leader has been locked up on charges of economic corruption and abuse of power. They wear stickers bearing the phrase, "Arrest me, I am Sloba." Many of them are middle-aged people and pensioners, feeling the sting of tough economic reforms implemented by the new regime in Belgrade. Others are cronies of Milosevic, nervous that they could be next to see the inside of a jail cell. As they demonstrated, another gathering was underway across town. The British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook, one of the leaders of NATO's 1999 bombing campaign, was wrapping up discussions with President Vojislav Koštunica and the Yugoslav Foreign Minister Goran Svilanovic. The talks focused on economic aid to Yugoslavia and the West demand for Milosevic to be handed over to The Hague. After the meeting, Robin Cook said he had not set a timeline for Milosevic's extradition, but he warned the government that failure to cooperate could bring economic consequences.
No, I want this to be a partnership. I want us to do this voluntarily. I would like the Serb people to understand why it is in their interests that they should comply with their international obligations, and why it is not in their interest to protect and to defend Mr. Milosevic. As I said, we want to help Yugoslavia. Yugoslavian return must help the international community. And there is, of course, obviously a limit to the extent to which we can proceed on our assistance if that partnership is not reciprocated.
But Yugoslav President Vojislav Koštunica remains adamant in his stance that his government will not be blackmailed by the international community over the extradition of Milosevic.
We are ready to cooperate, but cooperating doesn't mean accepting everything. It doesn't mean putting something that is national and state dignity above something that is a handful of dollars.
Back in front of the central prison, there was outrage that while Milosevic is locked up, Robin Cook was being welcomed. Ivana Ivković is a member of the Socialist Party of Serbia.
Why does our people let him come here? When will they pay for all the damage they have done here? And nobody can make those people that died from the bombardment alive now. So I don't know how can they come here. Him, Solana, Carlo Del Ponte, all of them together.
There is little doubt among Milosevic's supporters that his arrest was carried out last weekend on direct orders from Washington. The raid on his villa came just hours after a deadline set by the U.S. for Serbia to arrest Milosevic or face losing $50 million in aid and access to hundreds of millions of dollars in loans from the International Monetary Fund. Now there is an ironic scenario unfolding here in Belgrade. At this moment, perhaps Milosevic's best hope for not ending up at The Hague lies in President Koštunica, who has vowed not to carry out any extraditions. In his meetings with Western officials, Koštunica prefers to remind people like Robin Cook of the $30 billion in damage to the country's economy.
International community and United States owe, and to my personal feelings, much more owe to us than we owe to them. And I think that that moment will be prevailing and that we will find, way out of that possible, once again, difficult choice what we are going to do.
For the time being, Milosevic is charged with corruption. He's accused of stealing state money for his personal bank accounts, for which he could face up to 15 years in prison. Officials this week indicated they are considering adding charges of political assassination and possibly treason, an offense punishable by death. But the charges against Milosevic won't include war crimes, for which he's been indicted by the Hague Tribunal. Though the West now speaks of its new partnership with Belgrade, ordinary people still suffer from the effects of the NATO bombing. Many buildings and bridges still lie in ruins, while prices are on the rise and unemployment skyrockets. But those who carried out the attacks against Yugoslavia continue to defend the campaign, despite the talk of a new friendship.
Mr. Cook, even with the arrest of Mr. Milosevic, there are many in Serbia who believe that you yourself are a war criminal for having carried out the NATO bombing. Do you feel any remorse now coming to Belgrade, and have you expressed any remorse to the leaders of this country?
No.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jeremy Scahill in Belgrade.
A week after state regulators imposed the biggest electric rate hike in California history, lawmakers in Sacramento are considering what they call a windfall profits tax on power companies, a measure they say will bring prices down. Without it, they say, the 46% rate increase imposed last month will be just the beginning. Aaron Glantz reports from Sacramento.
The introduction of two windfall profits tax bills marks the first indication state lawmakers are getting serious about bringing down the wholesale price of electricity, a price they have so far been willing to pass on to consumers and taxpayers. Democratic Assemblywoman Dion Ariner of Berkeley wrote one of the bills.
A windfall profits tax is gouging the gougers. It's saying to the generators, particularly those out-of-state generators, who in some cases are now charging 1,400% over what their costs are to generate that electricity to the people of the state of California, you can't do that and get away with it any longer. We'll establish a rate, including a reasonable rate of return on your money, and anything above that, we're going to tax you back for that windfall that you're getting from us.
Profits for most power generating companies skyrocketed last year. Duke Energy's fourth quarter profits went from $35 million in 1999 to $169 million last year. During that same time period, Dynergy's profits went from $45 million to $118 million. Reliant Energy of Houston, Texas had the biggest profit spike from $143 million in the fourth quarter of 1999 to $631 million in the fourth quarter of the year 2000. Reliant used $100 million of that to name the Astrodome after its company. If passed, the bill would also result in a direct electric rate rebate for consumers, because every dollar paid in taxes by the generators would be put into a fund to lower utility bills. The bill is opposed by the business community and the power generating companies, who say they won't build power plants in California if they have to pay a hefty tax. Stephen Kelly is policy director for the Independent Energy Producers Association, the power plant lobby.
Out-of-state generators, suppliers, or whatever will probably move their product to regions in the West that are not faced with these equivalent taxes.
But power plant operators haven't pulled out of Montana, which is also considering a windfall profits tax bill. Montana deregulated its energy market at about the same time as California and is also experiencing price spikes. State Senator Jim Elliott describes what happened when he introduced a windfall profits tax bill.
What has happened in the state of Montana has disproved the argument that investors will not invest in the state if you're putting pressure on other companies to come to the table. What has happened in the state of Montana is the Northwestern Corporation, which is an outfit out of South Dakota that is taking over the rest of Montana Power Company's assets, has just come forward with a proposal to build new generation facilities in Montana. This is happening at the very same time that we are bringing perhaps the most pressure the state of Montana has ever brought against an industry, and the same industry that Northwestern is obviously involved in.
In the meantime, however, residents in California, Montana, and throughout the West will likely see higher electric rates, with massive profits going to a few companies in Texas, Oklahoma, and Pennsylvania. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Sacramento.
The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that Shell Oil must face a lawsuit which alleges that the company instigated the torture and murder of environmental activists in Nigeria by the former military government in that country, and that the company failed to adequately compensate communities whose land was poisoned by its drilling operations. Shell argued unsuccessfully that the suit, brought by the family of executed environmental activist Ken Saro-Wiwa, was beyond the jurisdiction of U.S. courts. The ruling came as the Nigerian government bowed to pressure from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, to deregulate the price of fuel in the country. That will mean higher prices for Nigerians, and the move has sparked angry street protests and rallies across the country by labor unions, students, and other mass organizations, who fear it will increase hardship in the country. The protests may represent a turning point against IMF and World Bank-inspired policies that have helped transform Nigeria, the world's sixth largest oil producer, into a place where multinational interests thrive while Nigerians sink further into poverty. Sam Olakoya reports from Lagos.
Thousands of angry workers and students shout abusive slogans against the World Bank, the IMF, and the Nigerian government. They are angry that the government wants to deregulate the prices of fuel in line with IMF and World Bank economic policies for the country. This railway worker says the protest is the beginning of a struggle that pitches the poor in Nigeria against the government and its Western collaborators who want to recolonize the country.
Enough is enough. Initially, they put a rope around our waist. They call it tight your belt. We develop monkey waist. And now they are taking the rope again to our neck so we can develop ostrich neck. We'd rather die.
Good day, Nigeria workers. Good day, Nigeria students. Good, good.
Elsewhere in Lagos, at an open field, 8,000 Nigerians gather for a protest rally. Dikpo Fashina, president of the university's academic union, says everyone is angry because the government wants to increase fuel prices under the guise of deregulation.
So deregulation is a phony cover for unbridled increase in the prices of petrol. IMF has said it, that we are paying too little for our petrol. And you have a government that does not believe in anything but the role of IMF and World Bank. Watch our president when he is with IMF and World Bank and officials of international finance capital. He's like a veritable servant. But when he's with his own people, he's like a boss.
Nigeria is owing international financial institutions $30 billion. The country is asked to deregulate fuel prices as part of its loan agreement with the World Bank and the IMF. Both financial institutions argue that at 20 cents a liter, Nigerians are paying too little for fuel. The government wants to increase the price by 100%. Average income is about $50 per month. Nigerians feel that their income is too low for higher fuel prices. Dikpo Fashino is surprised that Nigeria's civilian government, which is about 2 years old, allows itself to be guided by the World Bank and the IMF.
And that is the tragedy of what you have in Nigeria. You have a government that believes that IMF and the World Bank are the propellers of development in the world, quite contrary to the historical evidence.
Historical evidence is what many Nigerians are using to judge the World Bank and the IMF. Human rights activist Sylvester Odion Ahene joined the protest.
And basically, the World Bank and the IMF have inspired economic reconstruction projects all over Africa. And wherever they inspire these projects, it has meant more poverty and pauperization for the people. In fact, that is why today people regard them as, regard that system of interventions in the economy of various countries as, a merchant kind of system, whereby they intervene in this country, bleed them, in the name of reconstructing their economy and leave the country dry, nothing left for the people to enjoy.
In the 1980s, the economic policies of both financial institutions in Nigeria led to inflation, unemployment, and the devaluation of the local currency. The resultant hardship has persisted till date. Sylvester Odion Akhene says the plans to deregulate fuel prices will similarly lead to hardship.
The effect of deregulation of the energy sector is very clear. Nigeria, it's another developed country that relies on you know, the petroleum petroleum resources, you know, to power its energy setup. You need fuel to, you know, to power the motor vehicles, to bring food, food products from the farms and the rest of them. So what you are going to have is a bad one-go effect in terms of inflationary trend on the economy, you know, because prices will be adjusted upwards, you know, and there is no way Nigerians can cope with this.
But despite widespread opposition, the government says it is going ahead with plans to deregulate the price of petrol. Sylvester Odion Akhene says this is an indication that the government is under pressure from the World Bank and the IMF.
So when you see, hear a president telling you that there is no going back on deregulation, even when the people are opposed to it, it means only one thing, that he's been, you know, urged on by his Western backers. That is basically it.
We are workers fighting for our land in the name of Jesus. We shall conquer. We are workers fighting for our land in the name of Jesus. We shall conquer. We are workers fighting for our land in the name of Jesus. We shall conquer.
Workers, students, and other groups opposed to the increase in fuel prices are already singing a song in anticipation of victory as the battle line is drawn between them and the Nigerian government. Just who will win this crucial battle remains unclear. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
W.R. Grace & Company, a multinational chemical and insulation firm, filed for bankruptcy this week, leaving plaintiffs in 100,000 lawsuits up in the air. W.R. Grace operated the vermiculite mine in Libby, Montana until 1990, producing asbestos-laced insulation used in what may have been millions of homes. Miners, former and current residents of the town of Libby, and former workers at W.R. Grace are among the growing list of plaintiffs who are feeling the impact of the bankruptcy filing. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Lee Robartis has been following the story and files this report.
The town of Libby has already seen 200 asbestos-related deaths resulting from 5 decades as home to the open-pit vermiculite mine that W.R. Grace bought in 1960. Montana attorney Alan McGarvey represents 200 miners and families from Libby.
These people are very sick and often we've had our clients die while we were processing their claims through the court system. We're very unhappy to see this bankruptcy because what it means primarily for these seriously injured victims is a lot of additional delay before their claims can be resolved and they get compensation.
A few years ago, the Missouri-based W.R. Grace was a much larger corporation than it is now. It shed a number of subsidiaries, including one called Sealed Air. Now plaintiffs' attorneys are filing claims against Sealed Air, which manufactures bubble packaging. Attorneys say W.R. Grace spun off assets to the company 2 years ago in a purposeful attempt to hide from asbestos liability, a charge the company denies. Again, Alan McGarvey.
We believe it is very troubling that a corporation that was something on the order of a $7 billion corporation should be able to transfer assets and engage in corporate reorganizations, leaving a minor shell of a corporation to answer for the devastation to the victims of asbestos disease that has occurred.
McGarvey says it's up to the courts to decide if Sealed Air should be classified as a successor corporation that gained from profits made by W.R. Grace. Even more numerous are the product liability cases from around the country, which might result in smaller settlements. W.R. Grace has estimated its liability to be in the $1 to $2 billion range. Most of the new product liability cases are expected to be from those homeowners who installed W.R. Grace's insulation, sold under the brand name Zonalite. Renters and apartment owners are also potential litigants. Public relations specialist Greg Houston of New York, who consults for W.R. Grace, said he spoke to officials for the company who said they weren't interested in commenting on the bankruptcy for this story. In February, 30% of 1,000 Libby residents tested showed lung scarring associated with asbestos exposure. The Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry is now sending out 6,000 letters to current and former Libby residents containing test results. Libby, Montana resident Gayla Benefield says she gets calls almost every day from newly diagnosed locals who will likely die slow, painful deaths from asbestosis.
W.R. Grace has, on one hand, filed bankruptcy. On the other hand, they're announcing that they'll continue their medical program. They'll continue their contributions to the hospital. And yes, my husband and I both, with our reports, came back with scarring on the lung and the chest wall. And we haven't gotten the final diagnosis yet, so it's something we have to worry about for the next few weeks until we can get in the doctor. But I feel so sorry for the people of Libby and anyone else that's affected by this, because simply giving someone free medical care for as long as not they need it, but as the company deems that they owe it to these people, is not enough for what they're taking away from their lives. And I feel like the community and anyone involved in this has been completely robbed from any compensation.
Benefield says many of those diagnosed did not work in the mine or expansion plant. Scientists say those residents have likely been exposed from ambient air or the clothing of miners.
One thing, this is not a matter of a company going broke. This is a matter of a company conveniently hiding behind a bankruptcy. And they've advertised in the paper that it will be business as usual once this is over.
The EPA is in the middle of cleaning up the town, and since the mine has been shut down for 11 years, Benefield says it's relatively safe to live there now. She says she continues to watch the situation closely for the benefit of the children now living there. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lee Robartis.
A British High Court ruling handed down last Friday allowed a group of anti-nuclear protesters to go free. But it also called into question the protesters' attempt to demonstrate that nuclear weapons are forbidden under international law. In 1999, three activists accused of property destruction on a nuclear submarine base in Scotland successfully argued that their actions were justified by international law. That case opened the door for others to challenge the legality of nuclear weapons. But as Patrick Beckett reports from London, the most recent decision effectively reverses 10 years of anti-nuclear litigation.
The High Court ruling declared that the activists' actions were not justifiable under international law. They further ruled that the deployment of Trident nuclear submarines is not illegal. The three women acquitted of more than $100,000 damage to the research vessel Maytime in the name of disarmament still stand free, but the precedent their case set has been undermined. David McKenzie is with Trident Plowshares, an anti-nuclear campaign group. Plowshares has organized dozens of disarmament actions over the years, including the annual blockade of the Faslane nuclear base near Glasgow, Scotland. Almost 400 people were arrested at the gates of Faslane this February. McKenzie describes the court's ruling.
Their four answers in the negative meant, in effect, that they were attempting to rule Trident legal and also attempting to claim that the women had no justification whatsoever in what they did with Maytime in 1999.
Angie Zelter is a Plowshares activist and one of the women acquitted in 1999. She represented herself in the earlier trial as well as in front of the High Court. She points out that the decision reflects the British Ministry of Defence, or MOD, position.
This Lord Advocate's reference put Trident on trial, but they didn't really look at the evidence properly and put it side by side with international law. They only used a certain amount of evidence and then they distorted that to their own ends and came out with a very conservative MOD kind of line.
The decision suggests that courts in the UK are not qualified to hear cases relating to the legality of nuclear weapons under international law. Zelter says this puts government policy above the law.
And one of the bad things about the judgment was that it was going back to even suggesting that courts shouldn't even be allowed to look at the defence issues. Court that it's non-justiciable. In other words, they're saying that government defence policy can be above the law, but that undermines the whole legal system. That can't be allowed to continue.
While the Ministry of Defence would not grant an interview, a spokeswoman stated the ministry welcomed the High Court's decision. Furthermore, according to the ministry, the Lord Advocate's reference was only a matter of process. In their eyes, the legality of Trident nuclear weapons was never really in question. Anti-nuclear activists have argued for years that nuclear weapons are illegal. But it wasn't until 1996 that they received international support. In July of that year, the International Court of Justice issued an advisory opinion that the threat or use of nuclear weapons is generally contrary to international humanitarian law. Rebecca Johnson is the executive director of the Acronym Institute, which promotes nonproliferation and nuclear disarmament. She testified as an expert witness in the lower court trial in 1999. She says the recent decision indicates a return to that time when international law could not be used to argue against nuclear weapons.
What the Lord Advocate's reference has tried to do is to go back to that earlier position, to basically say international law cannot be used effectively as a defence for a domestic action.
Johnson believes the British courts are sidestepping the issue of illegality by claiming the International Court never ruled against the possession of nuclear weapons.
And so what Britain has been trying to argue is that the ICJ has no binding effect because it's only an advisory opinion. But I think that the case in Scotland made a very good case for the argument that really it does come into customary law. And the second argument that they used is that the ICJ deals only with use and threat of use and not with possession. And therefore it never said that possessing nuclear weapons was illegal.
If this is true, it would appear that a binding decision on the legality of nuclear weapons will have to wait until a wartime situation, a possibility activists aren't willing to consider. Once again, Angie Zelter.
Ultimately, change only occurs when large numbers of people force that on their government. And this issue of the state versus people and how the state can get away with threatening mass murder but an ordinary person can't, that can only be dealt with by ordinary people taking that power into their own hands.
This is Patrick Beckett, reporting from London for Free Speech Radio News.
Legislation is underway at both the local and national levels to combat discrimination and hate crimes against gays, lesbians, and bisexuals. Jacqueline DeSteiger reports from Portland, Oregon, where the county government is working on civil rights guidelines for gays and lesbians.
Crimes motivated by prejudice against sexual orientation, gender, or disability will be added to the category of hate crimes if the proposed Local Law Enforcement Enhancement Act of 2001 is passed. Senator Gordon Smith of Oregon and Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts have introduced a bill that would extend upon the current hate crimes legislation, which addresses violence based on race and religion. Currently, prosecution of hate crimes is restricted to crimes which prevent the victim from exercising his or her federally protected rights. The Enhancement Act would extend the possibility of prosecution to hate crimes that cause death or bodily injury. Senator Gordon Smith thinks it's important that the federal government support local and state efforts to combat hate crimes.
These category of crimes that are not just directed at individuals, but whole communities to single them out and victimize them in a way that ultimately leaves us all feeling as bad as possible.
According to the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, there are currently 22 states, as well as the District of Columbia, which punish hate crimes motivated by sexual orientation. Multnomah County, Oregon, is in the process of drafting a new non-discrimination ordinance to include sexual orientation, gender identity, and source of income. With regulations such as these underway, legislation to affect local law enforcement on this issue might seem redundant.
I think it's important to say that we won't displace them. We just simply are a backstop to them. And I just think at every level of law enforcement, it's a good thing for us to be able to show up, go to work, and turn what is a symbolic law into some real substance that we're not going to tolerate. This kind of bias, crimes, and hatreds to exist without the most vigorous kind of prosecution and incarceration.
Sven Von Chessen is the president of the Portland Bisexual Alliance and is a member of the Multnomah County Civil Rights Task Force, which is drafting the new non-discrimination ordinance. He and others in the community see a lot to be gained from the ordinance, but are wary of potential exceptions within the text that are inconsistent with the goal of protecting the civil rights of gays, lesbians, and bisexuals. They, too, want to take what is already in place and make it more complete so that their community is treated equally, not only in comparison to heterosexuals, but religious individuals and people of different ethnicities as well.
I've been bringing these concerns to each meeting as the analysis develops and as community members talk with me. And the task force, I think, has been really quite receptive. It's an enormous undertaking to put together this ordinance, and the more people participate in making sure that this is really not just any law, but a really good law that serves the people it's intended to protect, the better.
From Portland, Oregon, this is Jacqueline DeSteiger.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. I'm Matt Martin. Please tune in again next week.